Would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would, Your Honor. If I could at this time reserve 5 minutes.
Yes, sir. And you may begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Sean Domer. I work at the Suffolk Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant in this case, Tony Lamont Pugh. We are here today on appeal from four convictions, namely forgery and uttering in violation of Virginia Code Section 18.2-170, obtaining money by false pretenses in violation of Virginia Code Section 18.2-178, and unlawful use of identification material with intent to defraud in violation of Virginia Code 18.2-186.3. There were two issues that were raised on appeal, first being a best evidence objection, which was preserved during the trial at both transcript page or appendix page 63 and at the motion to strike at page 93. Second is the sufficiency of the evidence argument, which was preserved at the appendix at page 154. I will first address the best evidence issue because it doesn't necessarily require that we delve into the facts, but we will get to those shortly. Your Honors, the best evidence issue in this case, the standard of review on evidentiary issues is an abuse of discretion standard, as you well know. The abuse of discretion is described as a situation in which no reasonable juror could differ on the matter. A perfect example of a situation where that would be the case is one such as this, where the legislature has explicitly said what must be included on a substitute check in order for it to be admitted in lieu of the original.
Well, that's to be admitted as a substitute original, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, the original was unavailable, as explained by the Commonwealth, because the account with which the check was drawn off of had been converted to a paperless account. So there was no physical copy of the check. For that reason, the Commonwealth submitted the check that was purported to be a substitute check, and that was allowed into evidence over objection by the attorney who represented Mr. Pugh in trial court. Your Honor, the cases that the Attorney General cited to in his brief relate to substitute or photocopied documents. However, what we're dealing with in this case is a check. And the legislature specifically wrote out a specific guidelines that must be met when the Commonwealth intends to use a substitute check. So it is set apart and different from that of other documents that may be wished to be entered in lieu of the originals. And the guidelines are set out in Virginia Code Section 8.01-391.1. And that code section says that a substitute check created pursuant to the Federal Check Clearing for the 21st Century Evidence Act, found at 12 U.S.C. Section 5001 et sec., shall be admissible in evidence in any legal proceeding, civil or criminal, to the same extent that the original check would be. Section B then goes on to say that a document received from a banking institution that is designated as a substitute check and that bears the legend, "This is a legal copy of your check," you can then use it the same way you would as the original check, and it shall be presumed to be a substitute check created pursuant to the checking in the 21st Century Act. Your Honor, the check that was admitted into evidence in this case did not bear that legend, which is required under the statute. The check in this case bared a legend that stated, "This is an image of a check, substitute check, or deposit ticket. Refer to your posted transactions to verify the status of the item. For more information about image delivery, click here, or to speak with a representative, call 1-888-PNC-BANK. Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Saturday and Sunday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time." That is the end of the transcription. So there is nothing that meets the requirement of the statute for that substitute check to be entered.
Wasn't there testimony at trial that it was produced online from the PNC digital records set?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that was the origination of the substitute check that was purported to be used. But, Your Honor, I would submit that where the legislature has explicitly stated what needs to be included, anything that falls outside of those parameters should not be admitted. like I said, the standard is where reasonable jurists could not differ. Reasonable jurists could look at the statute, see what needs to be there, look at this check, determine that it is not there, and therefore come to the conclusion that it should not be admitted as a substitute check.
Did the Commonwealth ask to have it introduced as a, quote, substitute check, as opposed to a duplicate original or a copy under Rule 2:1005,
Your Honor, for example? I believe that the Commonwealth had the check entered as a substitute document. The check was objected to under a best evidence rule objection, and this specific exception regarding substitute checks is just a deeper part of the best evidence rule in a subset of rules that apply specifically to that type of document. Your Honor, the second assignment of error that was raised in appellant's brief was that the trial court erred in overruling Pugh's objection to the admissibility. The trial court erred in not granting Pugh's motion to strike regarding all charges, finding the Commonwealth presented sufficient evidence with regards to the mens rea elements of those charged offenses. The reason that that assignment of error is alleged is because in this case, the Commonwealth relied wholly on a permissive inference with the origination in the case of Spencer v. Commonwealth, a Virginia case from 1930 from the Supreme Court, which states that where the unexplained possession of a forged banknote on which the possessor sought to obtain money was prima facie evidence or a high degree of presumptive proof that the possessor was the forger. However, we said that such a presumption would not bind the jury with the force of conclusive proof. In all such cases, the jury to weigh the circumstances and draw from them whatever inferences they may warrant. From that case derived this permissive inference that where somebody uses a forged instrument which benefits them, it can be inferred by the jury that they are the creator of that instrument. Your Honor, the Supreme Court specifically laid out that the defendant could rebut that inference by presenting a reasonable account of how he came into possession of the check.
And whether or not his account is reasonable is something that's left to the fact finder. Is that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that's why I mentioned earlier that I didn't want to delve into the facts quite at that point, because I understand that the Court of Appeals has put in a unique and awkward position when it's asked to oversee the fact-finding of the trial court.
Is there any evidence in the record that would support the fact-finder's obvious conclusion that your client's explanation was not reasonable?
Your Honor, I would submit that there is nothing in the record. There was no evidence.
The fact that DMV's transfer of title shows a different amount than the check, a different gender of the person from the one to whom he transferred title, allegedly? That's not evidence in the record that would support the fact finder's conclusion.
Your Honor, the amount for the transfer, as indicated on the DMV transcript, was the amount of purchase was $1,300. The amount of sales tax paid was $76, which actually does match
Since
up.
When does person to person you have sales tax?
Your Honor, I can't tell you that. The only thing I can tell you is what is indicated.
So you can
on
tell me
the,
your client charged sales tax?
Your Honor, like I said, I can't say why there was sales tax applied
and
to it.
And sales tax based on what number? How does $76 match up with $1,300 from a sales tax standpoint?
Your Honor,
is that just your client's testimony that was sales tax?
There was no testimony provided to that. The only thing I can represent
Well, then
is
why
that
are we coming up with sales tax when that's not in the record?
It is on the record because it's contained within the document that was presented as evidence and accepted by the court in the DMV transcript.
Yep. And that cuts against your client, doesn't it? Person-to-person transaction where numbers that's being called sales tax, $76 on the $1,300 transaction?
Your Honor, I can't.
Doesn't help him, does it?
I can't say what the DMV charges sales tax for, does not charge sales tax for.
Well, DMV doesn't charge sales tax because it didn't make the sale.
Right, Your Honor, like what I'm saying is I can't say why it's reflected on that document. I don't know why it was included in the transfer. All I know is that that document shows that a car that was titled in Mr. Pugh's name on October 6th of 2013 was no longer in his name as of October 8th and then October 10th.
If you have evidence offered in rebuttal to the inference, Do you have to have anything in the record to refute this rebuttal evidence? Or could the trier of fact just not believe the rebuttal evidence? Just because it's offered, it is not believed, and that be sufficient to allow the inference to still be drawn?
Judge, that's the crux of the argument, is that where an otherwise reasonable explanation...
You said reasonable explanation. When you say reasonable explanation, I presume then the trier of fact gets to evaluate that explanation, which would mean that you don't have to point to rebuttal of the rebuttal evidence, but just that if what is offered is the explanation of why I'm in possession of what otherwise would be forged, and I would be presumed the forger, if my explanation is just not believed, it has not rebutted it, and so the inference still is permitted.
Yes, Your Honor, and the trier of fact is certainly within its authority to reject any testimony that it finds incredible.
However, was that what was done here?
Your Honor, it is what is done here, and what I'm asking the Court of Appeals to do today is to look at the evidence that was submitted and to find that no reasonable juror could have found his account of what happened to be unreasonable on its face, and when it was actually supported by the documentation that was admitted as evidence. That documentation that supports is what bolsters his story to make it reasonable. So my argument is that in the absence of any contradictory testimony or evidence presented by the Commonwealth, the permissive inference that's being applied here, and which gives the jury the ability to make that jump from he possessed the forged instrument to he created the forged instrument or knew that it was counterfeit at the time that he uttered it, it's being treated more as a presumption, which is not permitted.
It is a rebuttable presumption, and that's what we're talking about. We've really labeled all those terms, but that's what it is. You can draw it or not draw it. But what you're saying is this record, no reasonable man could possibly not have accepted the defendant's explanation for having this document in his hands.
Your Honor, no reasonable person
could have found that his rebuttal statement was not truthful.
When not successfully attacked by the Commonwealth or shown...
No, just on this record. Because it doesn't have to be attacked. But that the court, having found it not believable to have convicted had to, that nobody could have rejected this explanation.
Nobody could have summarily rejected his explanation with the evidence that he also presented to support his explanation.
Why do you need the word summarily?
Your Honor, certainly somebody could pick and choose parts of a story that they may believe or not believe, but wholly what is shown and supported by the evidence is that Mr. Pugh was in possession of a car, that car changed possession at or around the time that these offenses were alleged to occur, and that story corroborates the explanation for how he came into possession.
What about the difference between him selling it to a male and it's titled in a female's name?
Your Honor, the means that this transaction was carried out was over Craigslist. Craigslist is notorious because it gives people the ability to conduct these types of transactions with anonymity.
But this wasn't anonymous, because this man came with a check that he said was him as an employer, because his employer lent him money to buy the car. That's not just some anonymous story where two people don't even meet up. They meet at a designated place under designated terms and sell for a designated amount of money, and the person that titles the car as the purchaser is a female. Now, how does that support your client's version?
Yes, Your Honor. The mere fact that the car was titled in a female's name does not necessarily mean that the purchaser of the vehicle was a male.
It's not a mere fact, though, does it?
I'm sorry.
It's not a mere fact, though, is it? That's the owner of the car. The person that purchased the car is a female.
Your Honor, the person who titled the car is a female. That does not mean that the person who purchased the car was a female.
Well, that the fact finder can find differently, can't they?
They certainly can.
Especially when the person that titles the car says, I bought it for this amount of money.
Your Honor, that evidence was not presented.
It's on the title.
Yes, and the amount of money that
signature of purchaser.
Right, the amount of money that person claims they spent is equal to the amount of money that the check was written for.
Before you sit down, let me take you back to the best evidence. Rule 2:1003. Tell me where in that rule that says that it has to have those words, this is a legal copy of your check, you can use it the same way you would use the original check. Tell me where it requires those words to be admissible.
Your Honor, in Section B, it states that a document received from a banking institution that is designated as a substitute check, which we have here, and that bears the legend, this is a legal copy of your check, you can use it the same way as you would the original check, shall be presumed to be a substitute check.
So it doesn't require it to be admissible, it just creates the presumption.
It creates the presumption, Your Honor, but in the absence of that second part, just the mere statement that it is a substitute check doesn't seem to be enough under the language of that statute.
Well, it doesn't provide any other guidance except that creates the presumption. But then we have other rules that provide for admissibility of a duplicate or original or a copy when the original is unavailable, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. But that presumption only applies when both parts of the legend are there, that this is a substitute check and it's a legal copy. You may use it as you wish.
But the presumption just means that in order for it not to be admissible, you have to rebut that. It doesn't mean that it has to have that carry that presumption to be admissible, correct?
Your Honor, my position would be that both components of the legend are necessary in order for the presumption that it is a substitute
check. Except that's not what the rule says. It doesn't say these are required for admissibility. Those are required to carry with the presumption.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Aaron Campbell appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. Let me begin by the best evidence rule. It dawned on me when I was preparing for oral argument that I might have missed something when I was writing my brief on this case. What the defendant is arguing is that this is a substitute check, and it has to have these magic words in order to be admissible. I would argue that this was not a substitute check. A substitute check is really kind of a term of art that banking institutions use so they could transfer electronically checks from one banking institution to another in order to pay instead of having to have the original check. What this actually is really a photocopy or a copy of a check, which is actually governed by a different rule.
2:1005.
Yes,
subpart B.
Exactly, Your Honor. It's covered under that rule and the statute 8.01-391. And that's really what this is a photocopy of a check. I would disagree with the Commonwealth. I don't see anywhere in the record where the Commonwealth said we are submitting this as, quote unquote, a substitute check. They were just submitting this as a copy of the check that the victim had gotten from her online banking website. And I would say under the rules, a copy or a duplicate original is always admissible unless there is some allegation that this was not a true and accurate copy. And there was never any allegation below that this was not an actual copy of the check. If there was, then perhaps the Commonwealth could have put on someone from the bank and maybe the Commonwealth would have a problem. But there was no objection. There was just simply a best evidence objection. There wasn't any explanation why this was a best evidence objection. So we would submit that there was no abuse of discretion in submitting this check. This was a copy of the check under the rules and under the case law. It was clearly admissible. The defendant never disputed, even in his own testimony, never disputed that this was not the check that he cashed at that Walmart that day. Turning to the first issue, the court's well aware that there is a prima facie case when a defendant is in unexplained possession of a forged instrument like this in these types of cases.
You might have detected some skepticism from this side of the bench that no rational jury could have determined that the defendant's explanation for this was unreasonable. Can you tell us why the jury was within its province to find that his explanation was unreasonable?
I mean, first of all, I think this goes to Judge Baumgartner's point, is that when the defendant testifies, he places his credibility at issue, and it is the jury to prerogative to determine whether or not they find his explanation credible. And if they reject that, then I think that is binding on appeal unless there's no evidence or it's plainly wrong. And the courts pointed out a number of evidence that shows that the jury could have made this determination that this was not a reasonable explanation. One is that the defendant says that he got this check from some man. We don't have a name. We don't know who this guy was. Two, he presents this DMV record that, as the courts pointed out, it had a different amount on the check. There was a female noted on the title, not a man, as the defendant had said that he had sold the car to. I would also point out that the dates don't even match. It says it was sold on the 10th, and this transaction occurred on the 8th of October.
Defendant had impeachable convictions, did he not?
And that was my next point, Your Honor, is that he had a litany of convictions, including the number, he even admitted that he had committed a number of theft crimes.
How do you respond to your opposing counsel's statement that, well, it may have been a man there in the Walmart parking lot who presented the check, but he was purchasing it for this woman, Iris?
I mean, it's certainly something that the fact finder could consider, and it's a matter for the fact finder. I would submit that the DMV record actually shows that the purchaser was, if I recall, it actually says that the owner was the purchaser, but or at least there's an inference that the fact finder could draw that the owner was the purchaser of the vehicle. And it might hold some more weight if we actually knew what the guy's name was.
There's no name in the record.
There's no name. There's nothing in the record
to recall.
Yeah.
Is it not a reasonable inference that the fact finder can draw that it's convenient that we have no name of this person that we meet with because it makes it easier to come up with a story that you want to pass off as plausible?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, the bottom line is that this is a jury question. There's plenty in the record to show that the jury could have rejected this explanation that they did not find credible. And unless the court has any questions, I would just ask that the court affirm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will come down and greet counsel, then we'll move on to our final case.
All right.